Hi, everyone. This is Gary Barkalow and Sam Williamson once again for another Campfire Conversation / Garden Gathering. And tonight we have a friend of ours who is a Base Camp member. He's one of us. It's Justin. Justin has made a pretty large life change, which, you know, if you're in Facebook, you may or may not have seen a blog that he wrote about that. But when I read the change of direction, really of assignment, as we talk about that in the calling material, as soon as I heard about it, I read his blog, and I was just intrigued. And shortly after reading it, I emailed him and said, gosh, I'd love for you to get on the phone and talk to us about God's guidance in this, how he has reassigned you, what you're bringing to this assignment from another, what were the ways he captured your heart. And so, anyway, that's what we're going to do tonight. So, Justin, thank you for sharing some of your story with us tonight.
My pleasure, guys.
Yeah. Okay, so let me announce the present, but let me go back for a second. And so what everyone needs to know is you have now gone full-time, actually for a little bit of time so far, with a ministry called the Exodus Road. And this ministry works alongside of other ministries that are combating the whole human trafficking thing that's going on, that's becoming bigger and bigger. That's what you're doing now, but let's backtrack just for a little bit of this call to understand the context of your life a little bit. And what I know is that early on in your working life, Justin, you were a commercial pilot. How did
Yes.
you get into that? Why did you get into that? Why did you love it for a period of time? Tell us some about that.
I became an airline pilot sort of on accident. I became a pilot because it's every little boy's dream. So I just wanted to find the quickest way. You know, I got out of high school like most people do, and they don't know what they want to do. And I figured, well, if I was going to go to college, I might as well see if you can major in that. And sure enough, you can. There's some pretty big schools around the country where you can go and just specialize in becoming a pilot, whether that's to lead into corporate aviation or commercial or just as a full-time professional flight instructor. And so I went that route just simply because, you know, as early as I could remember, probably kindergarten, if not earlier, I just wanted to fly. And I don't know where that came from, but it had just always been my dream. And I was hired on at the airlines. I believe that I was 21 years old when I was hired on. Yeah, I was 21. And so I started out in the right seat, not knowing anything. And, you know, I had realized this dream, and I hear these people that say, gosh, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, and they're 30 and 40. And I'm thinking, man, I'm 21. This is it. This is the dream. And it progressed for a little bit, and then I realized, wow, I've lived the dream, and now I'm kind of over it. What next?
Uh-huh.
So, Justin, when you first took flying lessons at the university, had you ever flown a plane? Did you ever fly a plane in high school?
I started working on my private pilot certificate while I was in high school.
Okay, you did.
The first time I had flown, and I had only flown, I think, once commercially. It was four flights round trip with a connection, just halfway across the country when I was a freshman in high school. That was my very first time on an airplane. And then I started taking lessons in my senior year of high school. Or actually, I think it was my junior year of high school. Just, you know, I met a guy who his dad had an airplane, and it was sort of on accident. And, you know, and we started flying together, and I started taking lessons. And I kind of progressed from there. And so I knew what flying was about. And then I, you know, started going into school and then to the airline route.
Okay.
So then you talked about, you had a phrase a second ago about it, I kind of reached my dream.
Mm-hmm.
What caused you to leave being an airline pilot? What was happening about then that caused the drift, the change, the reassignment?
You know, and it was sort of a frustrating time because there's, you know, all these people trying to figure out, well, what do I want to do? You know, what's my life's calling? And one of the questions that you ask to get to the bottom of that is, what did you dream about when you were a kid? And a lot of people can't recall or can't get back in touch with that, and it's sort of difficult. But I knew I wanted to be a pilot. And the frustrating thing for me was, well, gosh, I am one. I realized that dream. Is there any other one that's there? And the thing that caused me to first start looking for something else was just frustration. Before my wife and I got engaged, I was already in the airlines, actually, before I met her, just for a few months. And one of the conversations we had that I was very thankful for was, hey, I'm an airline pilot. I'm going to be gone and traveling, and who knows where this is going to go. Is this something you're okay with? And what we both came to the same conclusion on was that we weren't happy about it, but we wanted to be together and we were okay with it. But it was really a strain on our marriage, just me being gone. And I had read a marriage counseling book while I was in the airlines, and there was a guy who had a counseling practice in Minneapolis, which is Northwest Hub, now Delta. And he said in there, the airlines have single-handedly kept him in business as a marriage counselor. And I could absolutely believe that, because the things that I saw, well, just while traveling around, you know, it's so easy to put yourself in bad situations. And I didn't want any of that. And then we started having children. And, you know, this is a good thing. I mean, I had control over my schedule to where I could say, okay, there's a dance recital on Tuesday evening, and then on Thursday morning there's a meeting at school, and then there's lunch with the kids on Friday. And I didn't want to have to pick and say, well, what's more important to me this week? I wanted to be able to do all of them. And so very selfishly, I decided that while I love this job and the pay is good, those were kind of the bookends, everything else in the middle, my relationships, my marriage, my spirituality, just having to miss church, being a very young Christian at the time, everything was just disjointed. And I had to make the decision that while I love the job and while the pay is really good, it wasn't fitting the lifestyle that I wanted to live, especially with ultimately, before I left, we had two young kids at home, and I left the airlines 2 months before our youngest was born.
So, Justin, you're talking about how the lifestyle was not the lifestyle that you wanted. You really wanted to be able to spend more time at home. You wanted to spend more time in a relationship with God. Now, if the airline job had been able to be an 8-to-5 job, Monday through Friday, would you have wanted to do it, or were you finding out that your life's dream that way wasn't as fulfilling as you thought it would be?
Well, you know,
even if the lifestyle worked, would you have wanted to continue?
I think I have two different answers for that. At the time, not having as much life experience as I have now, I mean, that was when I started. I'm 33 now, and so I started, I was 21, so that's, you know, over 10 years ago. Not that I have a whole lot more life experience since then, but I do have more. And so, you know, back then, I was trying to look for something that was more stable, because back then I just wanted to be home every night. I wanted to be in my own bed.
Right.
And it would have been great. And some of the schedules that I could fly were out and back, so they were really early morning, and I got done early afternoon. And it was great. I did that 3 or 4 days a week, and I had a ton of time off. But the airlines are so cyclical that I knew that that wasn't going to be consistent. And it wasn't. I did that for maybe 4 or 6 months, and then it was done, and it got really bad. But now, knowing what I know, because back then it was just, well, hey, let's just try and get a better schedule, and then I'll be happy just going here and doing this thing for money or for pay, so I can go back and live this lifestyle over here. And what I realize now is that that was sort of a compartmentalized view on life, where I think a lot of people will go to, they just put everything in compartments. They have Sunday morning compartments where they go to church. They have Monday through Friday, 8-to-5 compartments, and that's their work life. They have compartments in the afternoons where they spend it with family and kids for maybe an hour. And then they've got Saturdays. And I didn't want to compartmentalize. I wanted to have everything just be really consistent, where, you know, what I was doing for fun was also my work. And, you know, those volunteer opportunities that I had, well, why couldn't I do stuff like that for a living? And so now that I've got 10 or 12 years experience on that, somewhere along the way I began to see that I wouldn't have been happy. I mean, it would have been a drastic change for me to change my schedule and still continue to fly. I mean, it's something that I miss, but I don't regret leaving the airlines, and it's not something I'm looking to get back into. just because of how great I have it now and a lot of those things that I've learned along the way.
Okay, so tell us briefly what you've been doing in between when you left as a commercial pilot to this change that we're going to get into fairly soon. What did you do next and why?
I'll try to be brief on that because I did a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
And feel free to go deeper on something if you need to. I left to pursue what I thought I was really good at, and I was. And it's not what I'm doing any longer. In fact, I haven't done it in the last 4 years. In 2006, so about 7 years ago, I started the business, and I started the business with the anticipation of becoming self-employed, helping people get out of debt. And a lot of people are familiar with Dave Ramsey. I went and trained with his team for a week and launched the business basically doing the same thing. And that gave me the experience of launching a business, of growing it, of learning a lot of things, just trial and error along the way. And people started asking, how did you do this? Or do you have any observations of what I could do for my business? And I just, you know, freely offered advice and said, well, hey, have you thought about doing this? And it was a lot of fun to go out and I didn't charge for it. But at some point, I had so many people asking me for guidance that I said, well, I'm going to have to charge you because I've got these other people that I can't serve if I do that. And just remember the first person that said, okay, how much? And I had no clue. I didn't expect them to say yes. So I started doing that, and really in the process, to make that story shorter, just became a marketing, operations, technology sort of consultant in those three areas and figuring out how to tie them together. And I started with people who were just launching their own thing. Hey, I want to do a landscaping business, you know, sort of that entry level. You can start with no capital and figure out how to market your business, and slowly work my way up to traveling around the world working with companies, you know, all the way up to Fortune 500 firms. And there have been challenges along the way with those solopreneurs, the small guys, you know, like a lot of us are, and then the big companies. And so I still do a little bit of that because I really love it, but I don't do a lot of it because it's aggravating if I do.
Yeah. So you found that was pretty easy for you to help people out, to kind of see what they couldn't see, next steps, or, I mean, how would you describe that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So I became a coach, and in the beginning I called myself a financial coach. And ironically, I didn't even know coaching existed until I became one. I was trying to figure out, well, what do I do? And I spent about 2 years in the airlines just frustrated and figuring out, well, what's next? I have this sort of stable. I mean, I got hired before September 11th in 2001, so things were stable. And then there was this big upheaval. But I was trying to figure out, well, what's beyond this? And if I had realized coaching existed, I would have hired somebody to help me figure that out. And that's why it took me 2 years to figure it out. And it was an intense 2 years. So I figured that out and became a coach and realized that I think the thing that a lot of people are good at and can probably make a living out of, they don't quite realize that they can do that because it comes so easy to them. It was the thing that I had to get over was, hey, this is really common sense stuff. You put your numbers down on a piece of paper and look and say, we'll pay this off and this off and this off, and you're done. And while it was common sense to me, it wasn't to a lot of people. And I think that there's some really good folks in a lot of different areas that can help with careers, with fitness, with finances, with a lot of different things. And, you know, that's when I started really diving into that. It's interesting how I figured it out because I didn't figure that out until I started the business to actually help people do it. But, yeah, that was the big thing for me was determining that I had this gift, at least in a few very niche areas, where I could see things in other people's lives or businesses that they couldn't see. And that's when I figured out that, you know, hey, maybe I should do something with that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So take us to the moment, what you were doing just before you made the transition that we're going towards right now.
And to an extent, I'm sort of doing some of that. I've just scaled back on it a lot. And it runs the gamut. It's basically looking at somebody's business, whether that's large or small, and and figuring out where their issues are. You know, a lot of people say, well, I have a problem here. Can look at it and say, well, that's not really the problem. I think that's a symptom of something that's happening. We need to get and uncover the real problem. And a lot of times that's marketing. So I'll come in and especially what I've learned in the last year and a half is that I really like startup situations. I like the challenge of taking a new idea and trying to get it out there to the masses and see if we can make it catch on.
Are you saying you like to do the startup, or are you saying you like to help, like to consult with someone who's doing a consult startup?
I like both.
Okay.
Yeah. But here's the thing, because that's a really good question. When I first started consulting with that, it was enough to get in there and give ideas and see things happen. But there comes a point, at least for me, where I realized I wasn't seeing enough. Like, it's not, this is my personality. It's not somebody else's. It's not enough for me to throw ideas out. I wanted to actually see things get done. I wanted to see them through to completion. And that's when I started making this transition about a year and a half ago into figuring out how I could work in the businesses that I was helping. Not necessarily as an employee, but going beyond the consultant and throwing out a list of ideas to throwing out a list of ideas and then say, and how can I help you guys carry this out?
Yeah.
And so that's a really good question, because I like getting my hands dirty.
You don't want to just sit and give advice. You want to be involved in the process.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to sit in an ivory tower. You want to be in the trenches. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so now take us to, because we're 20 minutes into this call right now, take us into what happened recently. This trip that you went on to Southeast Asia, how were you invited? How did you get there? What was the thing that took you there, and then what happened?
So about 6 months ago, I think it was probably August of 2012, I heard a couple speak, and Christine was sitting next to me, and this was on a Sunday morning, and they had just moved back to the States from Southeast Asia. And we heard them just tell this story about a problem that's become a lot more trendy lately, and that's trafficking of people. And there's 27 million people in slavery around the world, more so today than at any other time in history, including when it was actually legal. And, you know, you hear about this, and it's kind of touching, and you hear the stats, and, okay, well, that's, you know, there's a big problem there. But for some reason, Christine and I, my wife, were just both really moved on Sunday, and, you know, we were in tears, and we were walking home that day with the kids, and we didn't talk for 5 minutes in that half a mile, Christine just looks at me and says, I want to give them all of our money. And the interesting part was that we didn't have any, because I had just lost the contract because I like to work with startups. They don't always make it. And, you know, when I was just really moved, and I felt the same thing, and we did some research and kind of looked at their website, and I ended up getting in touch with Matt. So it's Matt and Laura, the executive director, and his wife of the Exodus Road, and got in touch with, just reached out to him and said, you know, hey, can we meet? I want to figure out if I can help you. I saw they were looking for marketing help and all sorts of things, and their website was just really bad. And so we met a couple of days later, and I told him that his website was really bad, and he agreed. And, you know, it kind of became second place to the rescue work that they were doing, rescuing people out of slavery. And so I said, well, hey, I can volunteer. I mean, I want to help you. I don't have any money to give you, but I think I can pull a team together to do this. And Matt said, well, I'm going to Nashville to meet with some real heavy hitters and some music stars and folks like that in 10 days. Can you give me something by then? And I said, well, lucky for you, I don't have any money, but I do have a lot of time. And so we launched a website. It was basically what you see up there right now. We've gone through a lot of changes lately, but I launched that in 10 days. I pulled together a team of two other guys that volunteered their time. And, you know, they were just sort of impressed by that, and it wasn't something that I did where I said, you know, what I've done in the past, I've realized is that I've worked my way into things where I said, okay, if I want to get here, what do I need to do to get there? Whether that's a job or anything. And this wasn't, well, gosh, are these guys hiring? How can I work there? Can I do something for free and maybe they'll hire me? It wasn't that at all. It was just how big or small of a role can I play from my little town up here in the mountains of Colorado to the work that they're doing in other parts of the world. And for me at the time, it was doing a website. And so that was kind of August, September-ish. Somewhere along the way, they said, hey, we don't know how we're going to pay you, but we want to bring you on staff. And I said, well, that's great. I need some money, though. And we've never really worked that out, actually, to this day, how I'm going to get paid, up until a couple months ago, actually. So I started working really full-time, kind of as a staff member, but being paid just like a volunteer would get paid. They started paying me a few hundred dollars a month and wanted more and more and more, and I said, man, this is work that I love. And it's that startup, that same I think you mentioned, it's that startup mentality. Most nonprofits will never leave that startup mentality, and I think that's great because it's what I love. How can we take a brand new idea every week, every month, and see if we can run with it? And in December, I think it was maybe end of November, December of 2012, we decided that I was going to go over to Southeast Asia with Matt, and we did a number of things, including take some journalists over with us. And,
John Berquist mm-hmm. went over with you guys as well,
yes.
didn't he?
He's
listening right now and on. Okay.
Yeah. So we took John and another woman over, and I think they spent about 4 days with us, 4 or 5 days, and we had another church group at the end of that that we showed around. And you know, it was something where I was really moved before that. There were some, and it's hard to explain, but, you know, you hear something or you see something. It's probably a lot like love, you know. Well, how do you know when you love somebody? Well, you just know. And you still can't explain it. And that's sort of what it was with this cause. You know, I don't have any experience with trafficking. I've not known anybody to have problems with it. You know, there's nothing happening at my neighbor's next door, but it was just something that moved in my heart where I said, I've got to do something about this. And Christine's there too. And so Matt and I are over on this trip. And I don't know how deep you guys want me to get into this, but essentially we do undercover work, and we go into some of the darkest places on our planet. And places I didn't know existed until this trip. And we have guys who are basically full-time with us that are retired military, and they're doing this, and it's their living. And I'm over here in the States doing marketing. But when I go over there, everybody becomes an investigator, and we do what we need to do. We wear covert surveillance gear, and we have conversations with people, and we do the investigation-type work to identify where the traffic victims are, and then depending on where we are in the world, we partner with non-corrupt officials, which is sometimes difficult to find, mm-hmm. And we help them organize raids, and they carry out the raids and rescue these victims, and we help place them in aftercare. And I think the thing that really, really moved me was being on the other side of the world in a place I had never been to. I'd never been to Asia. And it's one thing to see the culture, and that's moving in and of itself, but it's another thing to hold the hand of a little girl and talk to her in broken English or broken whatever language she's trying to speak, and to get bits and pieces of her story and to know that she doesn't want to be there. And I say see, we're helping rescue boys and girls and women. But to know that they don't want to be there, and that to me, I mean, the average age of a kid that we're rescuing is 14 years old. And we've seen kids as young as 6 and 8 years old. And those are my girls. I've got 3 little girls, 4, 6, and 8. And to think that they could be in that situation, I don't care who comes, but I want somebody to come and rescue them. And I had to overcome a lot of stuff. My wife had to overcome a lot of stuff about the work that I did on that trip and that we do in general as a team. And that was the question we kept coming back to.
What do you mean you had to overcome stuff?
Just about, it's a really hard conversation to take into churches. I mean, we're missionaries. We operate a ministry, and I think Americans have really taken both of those words out of context, where we think a missionary is somebody who raises other people's funds and they go and sit in a foreign country on the beach for 2 years and they don't work, and there might be some truth to that, but I think we're all called to be missionaries. We're all called to go to other parts of the world, and that might be the other side of town, and talk to people. But the things that, so we're not a Christian organization. All of our executive leadership is Christian, and we're all evangelical Christians. But our organization is not a Christian organization, which makes it, it's a lot of fun to go into businesses with a message and, not have Bible verses, not that we try to hide those. But it's a hard one to take into churches, because we're going into places that a lot of Christians don't want to go. We're going into brothels and karaoke bars and strip clubs. And there's a lot of things that, it was really hard for me, and this was the thing that overcoming, because I was going out to Southeast Asia to see what this was all about, to get some video and some pictures, some tame ones, and use it in marketing and show people a little bit about what the area is like and what we do. And then it came up where, hey, are we going to go in and do some investigations? And almost instantly I thought, no, that's not for me. And then I was sort of overcome by this feeling of, well, if I walk by, if I'm just on the street, if I don't go in, and if I'm not there for these victims, for these kids in a lot of cases, then who will be? Are they sitting in there and saying, well, I'm waiting for a non-Christian, because it's okay for them to see this stuff, but Christians, they're probably not going to come in here. They need to guard their heart. It's okay, I'll be fine. Just another few years and my debt will be paid off. And it was a really hard thing. Well, it was hard at first, and then it became very easy, because I started talking to Christine about it. And she was the one that got me there. She said, I think you need to go into these places. And I said, I don't know if I want to. And so this whole conversation, it's difficult to take into churches, and it can be taken out of context. I thought, I'd go my whole life never going in the strip club. I'm fine with that. And that was pretty rampant in the airlines. I avoided it like it was the plague. And now here I am seeking it out, because that's where people are stuck. And that's where if there's somebody that's going to do good, and I think a lot of people have good intentions and they go to places and they pray, and there's a lot to be said for that, but there's also a lot to be said for taking action. And that's what I had to come to terms with, was because, at the end of the day, it's great to rescue one child. It's great to rescue 1,000 children. But is it okay to do it at the expense of losing my marriage? And I think there's a great argument to be said for no. I don't want to lose my marriage over this. But there's a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that if I haven't gone into enough detail for you guys, let me know and I'll go deeper. But that was one of the things that Christine and I really had to overcome was, it's one thing to just talk about it and to market it and tell people what the issue is and raise money so we can send people in. And it's another to go there and do the work when you're there and you're the only one there. And it was a tough decision on one hand, but again, on another, a very easy one.
So, Justin, let me just take you back a minute to when you heard this original presentation from Exodus Road, and you and your wife are walking home, and you're sort of, and your wife's saying, let's give everything we have. Now, here's my question. I'm sure that you've heard, because you've been in business and because you've been in the church, I'm sure you've heard hundreds of compelling stories about compelling causes. Why did this one not just make you say, I want to give some money, but say, I want to give my whole life? I mean, what inside you became so radically charged by it?
At first, I don't think that I knew. It's just something that, here's the cause, and I've always been very cause-related. I've raised money for prostate cancer in the past, and again, not been connected to anybody that had prostate cancer. But I think the big part of this was just the fact that, you know, there's kids that are my kids' age. And at what cost, what length would I go to get those kids out? And the way that a lot of trafficking works is that sometimes the parents don't know. In fact, a lot of times the parents don't know. They send their kids off because they're poor, and they send their daughters off to work somewhere, and they think there's jobs, and they don't know whatever happens to them. And I did, because I'm seeing a very, very small percentage of that. But we as a coalition, we see that happening, and we cannot just stand by and not do anything. And I think there's a lot of causes where I would say, no, okay, well, I see there's other people here that are more equipped than I am. What I was seeing with trafficking and the work that we're doing is that I'm not really finding anybody who's equipped, including us. I think that on any given day we'll readily admit to not really understanding what we're doing. We have no clue. I mean, the undercover work that we're doing, the video surveillance gear that we use, a lot of it is from watching movies like Jason Bourne and seeing, whoa, hey, look what he's doing. I wonder if we could cut into a backpack and hide a camera in there. And that's what we do. And so there's a lot of mystery in things that we do, and it's shooting from the hip. But I think the big part of that was, what if this were my girl? And somebody knew about it, and they weren't doing anything. And I would not be okay with that. And, you know, on behalf of a lot of the victim, I mean, we're always undercover. And again, I don't do a lot of the investigative type work. We have some amazing guys in the field that put themselves in danger almost every night. They are not being reunited with a lot of these victims after the raids. They're going in there and posing as a lot of these other sex tourists do. Mm-hmm. And they're going in there and getting stories and capturing footage, organizing the raid, and they're not part of the raid a lot of times because their cover would be blown, and now they can't go back into that village or down that street or into that brothel. And so for a lot of that, there's not very much closure. We don't see these girls. Now, we walk with them and help them get into aftercare, but we don't get to see a lot of that. And that's kind of hard. But I want to know that, you know, there's some family there that even though they're going to worry, that they shouldn't have to worry as much, because there are people out there like our incredible investigators that are doing this work to save their kids.
Well, a couple things. First is it strikes me that you just have some real heart for your family, because you originally leave the airline industry mainly for the sake of your kids and your wife.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And two is, when this thing stirs you, I said, what stirred you? You said, those could have been my kids. I have kids that age. Hmm. There's just something in you that is really stirred by your family out of a love and a care and a compassion and a protection for them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Bob Kane at Basecamp is wondering if you have familiarity with any of the other groups that do this kind of rescue work. Have you, you know, do you guys have any connections with them, Christian or non-Christian? Are you familiar with them? Are you? How does that work? Do these different organizations work together? Do they work separately?
Some of them don't. In fact, a lot of them don't, and that's what we're trying to change. I think we're a lot stronger together. And so the Exodus Road is really a coalition. We started out doing some of this undercover work, building relationships with local officials in certain places, because we didn't know anybody else who was doing that. And we're finding what we really prefer is, we prefer the guys, like a guy named James in Mumbai, India, that we just partnered with. He has a team of 3 investigators, and they are working on a raid right now to free 40 victims. And all it costs was $3,380 to do that. And so as a coalition, what we seek to do is to get these guys, these investigators, and there's 3 things that are happening, really: education or prevention, intervention, which is going in and doing this type of work, and then aftercare. And we have 16, I think, with James now, 16 members in our coalition, and so we're working together with them. We have media agreements where we've purposefully set up to where we say that we won't disclose who we're working with. We want to raise money for the Exodus Road, and write grants to those coalition members without having to use their names. We won't do that without their permission. So we work with a lot of big coalitions and a lot of really small one or two or three person teams that are out in the field, bare bones, doing really great work. We want to raise money and fund that work. And then there are a lot of really big ones, and we have some relationships with those as well. And, you know, some of them, they're all really great. Anybody who's out doing rescue work or prevention or aftercare is doing some really amazing things. And what we're really trying to do is bring people together, bring organizations together in the coalition, not so they can, you know, they can bend to us, but we bring them into the coalition so we can serve them. And so we do have relationships with a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you, because, Justin, I know you need to get back to the group that you were with here. So, Sam, that's a great observation about his leaving the airlines to have more time with family, and it's the love of family that compels him into this work. So let me ask a different question. Justin, I think that, you know, it's my thought that this work you're doing with the Exodus Road or anyone else, a lot of times people refer to a ministry as their calling. I believe it's just an assignment where we bring our calling, the effect of our life, the brilliance that God has given us. And he says, hey, I need this over here for this work I'm doing, and then I'll reassign you to another place that needs the glory of your life, your weightiness, your brilliance, your strength, when I need to take you somewhere else. So, I mean, I look at this as, this is your most current assignment right now. So in the light of that idea, of that understanding, what is the effect that God has a need of you to bring into Exodus, or Exodus Road?
Well, and I really appreciate that observation that Sam made just about family, because I've talked about that a lot. Funny, again, I'm on the inside, so it was harder for me to see that. But just that connection, I've always been very family-oriented, and that's, I think you're right on with that, Sam, is that I think that's why I'm so engaged in the work we're doing at the Exodus Road, just because of that love of family and children and women. And so this, you know, this effect that, I love how you refer to it as an assignment. Because again, you know, sometimes, a lot of times for me, I've pushed into things that I probably shouldn't have been doing. If I work hard enough, I can do this. And I think on the other end of that, you know, a lot of people are in a position where they say, well, I'm going to wait on God. You know, he'll come through. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. But what I see is a lot of people spending too much time waiting and not enough time doing. And my problem, I realized over the past about 4 months, was that I was on the opposite side of that, and I didn't think that was ever going to be a problem. I spent too much time doing and not enough time stepping back and saying, God, where do you want me?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want me to do here? And there is no, hey, do a whole bunch of hard work, Justin, and you'll make something work out because I needed some income. That wasn't happening this time around. And so really God has me on this assignment, I think, because of everything that's happened over the last 7 years, and probably much sooner than that, or much, much further back than that, is that I learned how, by trial and error, to market and to grow a business, and not just a business, but an organization that does things. And along the way, he's put me in these roles, and sometimes I'd work at them for a short period of time, and then they'd be done, and I'd move on, and what I'm finding now is that I'm using all of that collective wisdom that I've used over the years to help grow something that I really care about. You know, it's one thing to make toilet paper or whatever you're going to make as a widget. And, you know, some people are really into that, but it's not me. And so what I really have found that I love doing is working with an organization that has a part in making the world a better place and improving lives. And I can see that one person at a time. And so I love how you speak about assignments, because that implies that as much as I'm loving that right now, it might not be my assignment for very long. It might be a short assignment. It might be a really long one. But I have to have enough wisdom and patience to realize when it's over and I'm moving on to the next thing and not see that as a disappointment, but something to look forward to.
Right. And you know what I love about your story, too, is you just, to me, exemplified this idea that we are aware of a lot of needs in the world if we live open-hearted, eyes wide open, and so on. But God will bring us next to something where it goes from someone has got to do something about this to I have got to do something about this. And then it gives direction for the effect of your life. And I just think this is just an amazing story of that kind of an idea.
That's good, Gary. That's good.
Well, and I have to thank you guys for this, too, because it was 14 months ago that I attended a calling intensive with both of you guys. And, Gary, I've known you for a couple of years now, but we haven't gone real deep on this stuff. And I'll say that I didn't figure anything out, and I don't think people are meant to by spending 4 days out there. But I got it was another piece of the puzzle. In fact, it was like the whole outside edge of the puzzle, spending 4 days working through some of this stuff, and it was amazing. And I'm still putting a lot of those pieces together. I don't know what percentage I have done. I feel like I'm in a really good place, but, you know, who knows what the next 3 to 5 to 25 years will bring. But you guys were a hugely instrumental role in helping me get to where I am now.
Well, that's really fun to hear. That is. I mean, I think we can do that for each other. I think we do that for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Sam, did you have a final question you wanted to ask? Or?
No, I didn't. I mean, I can always think of more questions if you're giving me the microphone, but I don't have anything sitting burning right now.
Okay. Well, let me ask a question that John Hart asked. I'll simply read what he wrote on the chat line. He said, from Justin's blog article on this change, he wrote, quote, the potential to make millions of dollars definitely hung in the air. So these are your words, Justin. It would have been a long, tough road, and if I wasn't in 100%, I knew I'd begin to resent having to do the work every day. Could he comment on the part about resenting the work?
Yeah, so what John, I think was his name, referring to is for a few months there, I was co-founding a social app with some people here in Colorado Springs, and it had the potential to make millions of dollars, and it was a hard decision to give that up. And somebody in the comments said, well, hey, you know, it would have been worth it to work there for 4 years if you were going to cash out for millions of dollars, and that would have been millions of dollars that you could have put towards rescue. And it's a valid point. What I didn't want to get stuck in doing, there's two things with this. What I didn't want to get stuck in doing was, as I mentioned there, resenting the work where, all right, I'm here and I have to build this, but it's something that I'm only doing as a means to an end, and I don't ever want my work to be a means to an end. I want my work to be fulfilling for me, and I want it to be purposeful to the people that it touches. And so if you're out there manufacturing toilet paper, you're certainly going to touch a lot of people.
You keep talking about my chosen calling. No, go ahead.
Well, that's how you touch people, Sam. So.
Exactly. And you
do okay, anyway.
Anyway.
And if that's your thing, then you know, then go out and do it well, because that's your thing. But co-founding this app, and I think it has an incredible potential to be huge, and it's something that people will be hearing about over the next 2 to 3 years, very likely. What I saw was that while it was enjoyable for me now, it wasn't anything like this thing that I know I'm supposed to be doing, and that's why it was a really hard decision for me to leave. Because it was something that I enjoyed. It wasn't this thing that I hated and I needed to get away from. Something that I really had a lot of fun doing. But I knew that in order to get to the place where it was going to be a cash out for millions of dollars, it was going to be another 4 years, 3.5 years from now. And I can see getting to a point where I'm just going, you know, I'm coming in and punching the clock, so to speak, just so I can leave and my mind is always somewhere else. And that's not fair to me or to my family, and perhaps most of all to that employer. And so, you know, I didn't want to imply with that article that I was giving up millions and now I have to live the Mother Teresa life. I don't think that's that's it at all. I mean, some people work in nonprofits and they make a very healthy living. I don't think that's where I'm going to be, but, you know, God continues to surprise me every day. All I'm saying is that I'm open to wherever he sends me right now because I love the work and I see that it's having an impact on people. And if I can figure out how to make a living doing it, that's where I'm going to spend as much waking time outside of the time I spend with my family.
Yeah. That, and you know, the thing that strikes me too is I have known guys over the years, probably over the last 20 years, who were making good money and said, you know what, when I reach this goal of this much money, I'm going to quit and I'm going to go into ministry. And of the guys I know their story, that, and they said that to me, every one of them lost all of that money before they reached their goal.
Hmm.
And it is as if God said, see, you're trying to be dependent on yourself for this. You can't do that in this. That's not the way this works. When I resign, you go. And it's just unique. Every guy I know that told me that, in all different circumstances,
No
one knew each other. That was the case 100% of the time.
Yeah, and this is the first time I've ever really wrestled with, are you sure I should be doing this? You know, it was first of all trying to figure out where the money was coming from because I had let go of had been laid off from a startup. And then I let the social app go and there wasn't any pay there yet anyways. We didn't have any investors yet. And to just sit back and say, all right, what should I be doing? I mean, there's a lot of opportunity here, but it's giving up. It's really figuring out where should I be right now. And money shouldn't be the thing that enters into it. When you let go, and I say this very carefully because there's some people that ruin their whole lives and they end up having to leave their families and ending up in homeless shelters because they say, God will provide, and I'm not going to go out and get a job because God will provide. And, hey, God's providing you a job. You just got to go out and get one. I don't have an answer for anybody on that. That's up to them and figuring out where that is. And I think God put some people in situations where they're unemployed for a lot longer than they want to be. But that's really a thing between you and God. And I will also say, you and your community, the people that are closest to you, because at no point in the past couple months have I heard God saying, Justin, do this. But there have been more times than I can count where multiple people, all independently of each other, have said, hey, you should do this. And I'd say, whoa, were you just talking to Kevin? Were you just talking to Gary? Who are you talking to? Well, no, nobody. It just seemed like I should tell you. Oh, okay. And they're all telling me the same thing. And I think that it's different for everybody again, but I think that's how I hear best from God is through other people. And so I intentionally spend that time seeking other people out and not only getting from, you know, getting from them, having them talking to me, but also being a part of their life so I can do the same for them.
Yeah. Well, Justin, thank you. This has been, I mean, here we are. We're almost at an hour, and it's felt like far less than that. Mm. And what's so fun is to hear a current moment story about just following God. Because, you know, often we hear stories, but it was, you know, 10 years ago, but this is right now in the middle of it, which the funny thing is we all live in the middle of it. Justin, thank you. And so, hey, everyone out there, I want to encourage you to look at the website that we've put up on the both chat lines. And that link that I gave you specifically goes to Justin's page. I encourage you to look at that and see about helping them out. I mean, I'm just flabbergasted of how little it would take, you know, for instance, the example that Justin gave us to rescue 40 kids. That's just phenomenal. That's nothing. So with that note, Justin, thank you once again so much for doing this call with us. And just keep us updated. You know, you keep us updated on Basecamp. I'll also make sure that we keep the group in Sheer Beauty updated as well.
Will do, guys. Thanks a ton for having me on. It's always great to talk to you guys.
Hey, thank you for coming on. Thanks for joining us and sharing.
Yep, really good. So, everyone, thank you and good night.